My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people want to make friends. I'm just trying to make you some money. My job is not just to entertain, but to educate and teach you, so call me at 1-800-743-CNBC or tweet me at Jim Cramer. Tough days don't last forever, but when they come along, you need to know how to respond. You need a game plan totally developed and ready so you can decide what kind of self we're dealing with. I wish I could say that we always know how to respond, but the early days of the decline, well, they're never easy to navigate. First, let's borrow a line from Tolstoy's fabulous Anna Karenina. All happy rallies are alike. Each sell-off is unhappy in its own way. It's so true. Bull markets send stocks higher, and everyone thinks they're a genius for participating in them because it seems so darn easy. Big declines? Much harder, because they could be the start of a bear market. They could be just the beginning of something unfathomable, or they might actually be a buyable glitch. That's why I want to use history to try to identify some of the common qualities so that you can figure out how to handle these inevitable moments of weakness without panicking. First, let me offer some historically constructive words of relief, sanity, and real, not phony, but real assurance. There have only been two truly horrendous sell-offs since I started investing in 1979, the one-day crash of 1987 and the rolling crash of 2007 to 2009. I could have done the NASDAQ crash, but the S&P held up pretty well. Let's deal with these two big ones, though, head on. Because these two declines are great examples. They're polar opposites of each other, even as the percentage declines were somewhat similar. On October 19, 1987, Black Monday, the Dow fell 508 points, or 22%, in a single session. 22%. I was trading that day, and even as the previous week had been one of the worst weeks in market history, Monday hit fast and it hit hard. It was almost as if there were no buyers to be found, from Dow 2,246, where the crash started, to Dow 1,738, where it ended that day. It was selling off right into the close. I remember thinking, saved by the bell, except it felt like there weren't many left to be saved. What most people don't remember, as I mentioned, is that the week before was one of the market's worst weeks ever, as the Dow had already plunged from Dow 2,500 to 2,245. That's a 10% decline. That encouraged bargain hunters, and they turned out to be classic bad money in retrospect, because these intrepid souls thought they could flip Monday morning into some strength, and that strength never developed. In fact, the weakness that they were buying occurred the next day into what became known as Terrible Tuesday, where the Dow actually kind of just broke down. The market simply stopped functioning. But you know what? I was there, and I was actually able to calculate that bottom, the actual bottom that occurred, and it was around Dow 1400. That was off another 338 points from where the market closed on Black Monday. Then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan stopped the decline in its tracks when he said he'd provide all the liquidity necessary to stabilize the market. I still remember that green line when it came over your screen. Whew. He enlisted multiple firms around Wall Street to help put in the bottom, and the market staged a remarkable two-day rally that took us up more than 500 points. The effects of the crash lasted for 3 months, when we had a retest that held. But you know, it took almost 16 months until the averages returned to where they were trading before this big breakdown. The bear market that began in October 2007, it was a totally different animal. The Dow fell from 14,164, and it didn't bottom until March 9th of 2009, when it landed at 6,547. We didn't return to that hallowed 2007 level until March of 2013. Why did one sell-off end so quickly while the other took 6 years to unwind? That's the question that defines the two extremes of unhappy sell-offs. The initial one, Black Monday, was a mechanical sell-off, the first one I can remember that occurred simply because the stock market failed to be able to function. It's instructive to unpack Black Monday, because the way it played out was reminiscent of two other crashes, the flash crash of 2010 and its doppelganger in 2015. You may have heard theories about what caused these three crashes, but most of them are wrong, okay? All three started with the stock market futures, the S&P 500 futures in Chicago, overwhelming Wall Street, New York, where the stocks underneath are traded. Black Monday happened because stock traders didn't understand the power of the futures market, which could flood the stock market with instant, unseen supply. supply. These days, we accept that the futures are worth watching. But you know, it wasn't like that back then because they were relatively new instruments founded 5 years before the crash. The power of the futures snuck up on the peoples because they were initially a much smaller market than the stocks themselves. Because of their great liquidity, though, the ease with which portfolio managers can go in and out of them, they became the most powerful drivers of stock prices, even more powerful than the actual performance of the underlying companies that stocks are meant to represent. Underlying companies' earnings used to mean much more. Now it's really these futures that matter. The thing is, even with the relatively new impact of futures, Black Monday was unusual. We had had a big run going into 87. It was a remarkable multi-year rally with nary a substantial decline, and don't I know it. I left Goldman Sachs that year to start my own hedge fund because my returns had been so bountiful. The multi-year rally created such stupendous gains that a group of clever salespeople started selling what they claimed were insurance policies that could lock in gains and stop out losses for big funds. So-called portfolio insurance involved what was known as dynamic hedging. Oh, it sounds so dynamic hedging. Where these specialists said that using futures, you could ensure that you would no longer be exposed to stock market risk, say down 5% or 10%, or whatever the policy you took out determined. The idea was that they'd let you sidestep the losses. I have to laugh. Sidestep the losses. It's impossible to do that. Unfortunately, much like communism, portfolio insurance is well conceived in theory, but it doesn't work in life. The losses all kicked in at once on Black Monday, and the insurance didn't work. If anything, the future selling from the insurance accelerated the decline and caused incredibly large losses for the actual insured. The people who sold these policies were charlatans and mountebanks. They were never exposed as such, other than just now. But that's exactly what they were. There's no magic trick that can get the returns from investing in the stock market without much of the risk. Don't believe anyone who ever tells you any different. Of course, at the time, we didn't know that the power of the futures could cause a crash. We figured where there's smoke, there's fire. If the markets crash, then there's got to be something real wrong with the economy. There simply had to be a recession lurking. There had to. At least that's what we told ourselves. Wrong. The economy was strong going into the 87 crash, and it was strong coming out of it. There just wasn't any economic correlation with Black Monday at all. It was the interplay between Chicago and New York that set off the conflagration. And when the Treasury Department examined what occurred that day in a huge report, it concluded the future set off so much selling that some specialist firms on the floor of the exchange and some brokerage houses failed to step up and stabilize the tape. The latter had no duty to do so, but the former were supposed to do it, and Treasury found that many didn't do their jobs. I was fortunate enough to be in cash on Black Monday, having liquidated my portfolio early in the previous week because the market had acted so badly. It made my career. For the next 14 years of professional money management, I could show prospective investors that I had sidestepped the crash for real. Oh, they thought I was a genius, but the truth is, I was just frightened of the market and wanted to regroup. But as I never tire of saying, it's better to be lucky than good. So here's the bottom line. Sometimes crashes have nothing to do with the economy. They're caused by the mechanics of the market. Stay tuned for more examples of this kind of decline and the more serious animal, the bear market of 2007 to 2009, so you can figure out what to do when they happen. Let's go to Keith in Texas. Keith!
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Pretty good. My question is, how do you decide when a correction like we had back in February has made a bottom and it's okay to get back into the market?
Well, what I like to do is I like to see, try to get a sense on whether the selling has run its course. And what it takes to do that is to be able, first, you get a level where it bounces, and then it comes back and it tests that level. If that second test, as we call it, holds, then it's more than likely that you have to come back from the sidelines and
buy, 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 buy.
Sometimes crashes have nothing to do with the economy. They have to do with the mechanics of the market. Knowing how to respond is essential to your money. On Mad Money Tonight, my seller strategy session continues. Don't miss my take on the micro crashes that may be short, but could have lasting effects on your view of investing. Then, you might know Chicken Little and the Boy Who Cried Wolf from Fairy Tales, but they also play a role in the stock market. And is it all the Fed's fault? Not always. I'm eyeing the rational reasons, rational, that the market declines when it comes to the central bank. So stick with Cramer.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on Twitter. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Tweets. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
Welcome back to a special How to Deal with All Sorts of Declines edition of Mad Money. We've already covered what happened in the crash of 87 and how it wasn't really related to the economy. Shocker. So it was okay to buy stocks in that weakness. 1987 was a rare opportunity that took a little time to reveal itself, but when it did, ooh la la. It was also the first instance of the S&P futures exercising their pernicious power over individual stocks. They were like playthings, the stocks. Sadly, it was the first of many. Which brings me to the fabled flash crash of 2010. One of those negative moments that drove away so many investors who never came back to stocks because they didn't know their value could be destroyed so quickly, almost whimsically. Who wants to keep their life savings in instruments that can blow up in the blink of an eye? What happened that afternoon? It was pretty much the same deal as Black Monday of 87. The futures overwhelmed the stock market, and buyers just walked away, betting there had to be something substantive behind the destruction. It couldn't just be the machines breaking down, for heaven's sake. Flash crash started at 2:32 p.m. on May 6th of 2010. It lasted for 36 minutes. In that 36 minutes, the Dow fell almost 1,000 points from roughly the 10,000 level. It was memorable for me, because I happened to be on TV at the same time. Some money managers had been speculating that the market was going down precipitously because of riots in Greece. Oh, Greece was on everyone's mind back then because there had been endless worries and hand-wringing about what would happen if the Greeks defaulted on their bonds. Others pinned it on newfound weakness in the U.S. economy, which, for the record, there really wasn't any. Perhaps because I had the benefit of trading on Black Monday, I recognized exactly where what it really was when it was happening. Another situation where the futures were overwhelming stocks and the machines were breaking. We didn't know at the time, but a gigantic error in sell order caused tremendous fear that spread like wildfire, and many buyers simply disappeared. They didn't want to wait around to find out what was causing the landslide. They just wanted to get away from it as fast as they could. On air, I called it a phony sell-off because the decline had no basis in economic reality, which made it a tremendous buying opportunity.
What we're seeing right now, I mean, I believe unprecedented.
It can't be there. That is not a real price. It's too bad. The system obviously broke down. We're going
to
find out that there was a glitch in the tape. There was a glitch in the tape. The machines failed. And it obviously broke down.
It obviously broke down.
No, the market didn't work. It broke down. The machines broke down. That's what happened. It didn't work. The machines broke down. And that's what happened. More on that later. While some listened and actually bought stocks, and we're going to talk about that too, many people simply didn't believe that equities could be that fragile. It was shocking. In all the years I've been doing this show, I hope I've taught you that stocks are not hard assets. They're subject to all sorts of whims that can reduce their value in a heartbeat, including mechanical issues like those that happened during that 36-minute sell-off. Anyway, the market quickly regained its equilibrium, but not before another round of individual investors left the asset class entirely and never came back. Okay, how about the August 2015 sell-off where the Dow fell 1,000 points right at the open? That one was seemingly related to fears that the Fed was itching to raise interest rates right into the weakness in the what was happening in the Chinese market. Not our market, as the Chinese market had just fallen more than 8% in a single day. Many seem to forget, but back then, the Chinese market was the most dominant negative story out there, as people fretted that the whole economic edifice of the PRC could collapse from too much leverage and too little liquidity. Somehow, I find myself on air at all the right times to witness these events. That Friday before the sell-off had been a monstrously ugly day, as a Fed official late in the afternoon had suggested it was time to raise rates. despite the Chinese sell-off. It was an aggressive statement that demonstrated a cavalier attitude toward the market's ugly but also fragile mood. When we came in on Monday, August 24th, we heard that there were some very large sell orders in places for major stocks. I mean, we weren't ready, though, for the gap downs we saw, where big capitalization stocks were shedding hundreds of billions of dollars of value, with many 20% down as the market opened. Like the crash of 87, it was very tough to tell what the real prices were. The confusion was that horrific. It was like the fog of war, the fog of trading. But the Dow ended up tallying a decline of about 1,000 points when the smoke cleared at 10 o'clock. I and my partners on Squawk on the Street were pretty stymied at the time. You know what? I remember turning to David Faber to chat about the meaning of the sell-off in the midst of the conflagration. His reaction, priceless.
The Dow is down 1,000 points. And the losses on some of these names, UNH, Verizon, GE, down 13%.
I got to make some phone calls because these are enormous moves.
I got to make some phone calls. I remember what he said. I said, yeah, that's it. I got to make some calls. That's how confused we were. Again, we figured there had to be something. I mean, you get that kind of decline, right? There had to be something going on in the economy. Somebody knew something we didn't. Something mysterious, something otherworldly, something nefarious. Maybe China had actually collapsed. Maybe there had been something that occurred in Europe we didn't know about where the economy was still fragile that warranted the decline. I was suspicious, though. Suspicious because some of the hardest hit stocks were the recession-proof names, especially the biotechs, which for some reason declined harder than almost all the rest of the market. Think about that. That shouldn't be happening. If there was really something wrong with the economy, that's what people buy. Those stocks are often the safest of havens in moments when it's the economy that's at work. Once again, I suggest that it was the machines that were causing the problem, that the futures should overwhelm the stocks, and that the computers, they'd gone haywire. By mid-morning, we learned that was exactly the case. And the stock market then underwent a beautiful metamorphosis, a furious rally, jumping 500 points from the bottom. Strong stomach buyers came in and took advantage of that opportunity. The economy was gaining strength, not losing it. But a thoughtful Fed actually wasn't about to tighten, well, not with China teetering. It was an excellent time to buy stocks. Why was there such fear and confusion at the time of both the 2010 and 2015 mini crashes? I think investors weren't ready for either flash crash because post-1987, the government had put in what are known as circuit breakers. They were supposed to cool these declines by stopping trading momentarily. But these circuit breakers created a false sense of security that oddly still exists today, even as they failed to work properly on both occasions and did very little to stop the destruction. So please, when you hear talk of circuit breakers protecting you from fast declines, no, don't believe it. Fear can't be legislated or regulated out of the market. It will always be there. There will always be people who react horribly after an initial event, even if that event is mechanical and not truly substantive in nature. So what's the bottom line here? If you can determine whether a sell-off is caused by the mechanics of the market breaking down, then you might have an incredible buying opportunity. First, though, you have to figure out whether the sell-off is related to the fundamentals of the economy. If it is, then stay tuned. If it isn't, stay tuned anyway. But recognize that you have a first-class panic in your hands and nobody ever made a dime panicking. But boy, oh boy, did they coin money taking the other side of the trade. We're going to go to Jeff in Florida. Jeff!
Your Majesty of Mad Money, it's an honor.
You are very, very kind. What's going on?
You're welcome. Here's my question, Jim. Is there an equation, a formula, a rule of thumb, anything to dictate when or especially what percentage of profits to take off the table when really good gains are up for grabs?
Well, you know what? I have had, you know, the show's in flux at all times. I always try to measure these things. And what I've come to realize is that I used to tell people when things were really bad in the market, you know, look, up 25%, take some off the table. But for ActionLearnersPlus.com, what I've learned is you got to be a little more patient than that. When you have a really good stock, goes up 50%, then you start taking some off. And then 100%, then you take out that, you take out your basis, how much money you put in, and then you let the rest ride. I'm not as anxious to trade or recommend trading as I used to. I like longer-term investing. The situation has evolved. Remember, nobody ever made a dime panicking, okay? If a sell-off is caused by the mechanics of the market, you may actually have an incredible buying opportunity. Much more mad money ahead. The market's falling. The market's falling. It's more than just a nursery rhyme. It could teach you a lot about investing. Then don't get fed up. I'm breaking down the Fed Reserve's role in the market. And a sell-off versus a buying opportunity, the key to telling the difference is a little something I like to call systemic risk. Stay tuned. I'll explain. And stick with Cramer. Here we are, back discussing what to do in a sell-off.
Sell.
And how to figure out what the right approach is, given how difficult and different they all are. We covered the crash of 1987 as an example of one of the most horrific and quick declines imaginable. And yet there was no economic ramifications whatsoever. Many thought we had to be on the verge of a recession because the stock market projects what is supposed to happen in the future. It's kind of an early warning system. But not that time. It was a sell-off full of sound and fury that signified nothing. Same with the two flash crashes that we've been through, 2010 and 2015. The sell-off of 2007 to 2009, though, was exactly the opposite. It was a multi-year decline that started when the Federal Reserve raised rates 17 times in lockstep, trying to cool an economy that had already long since cooled off. It's the most dangerous kind of sell-off. What we call a systemic risk decline, and it's one that we can't trifle with, and we got to spend some time on. Fortunately, they don't happen very often. Call it, say, how about twice in 80 years? The first being the Great Depression. Unfortunately, every time we have a severe couple-day decline, we hear this Great Recession bear market invoked. Lots of investors scurry out believing that the sky is falling, and then they never come back, and they lose money, and it's breaking my heart here. So let's set the stage. Back in October of 2007, the stock market peaked at a little more than 14,000 when, as I mentioned, the Fed raised rates over and over and over again 17 times. And the economy, after teetering for just a bit, fell off a cliff and took the stock market with it. It's one of those things that you could have seen coming if you had paid attention, done a lot of talking and some homework, or at least paid attention to me. When back on August 3rd of 2007, I excoriated the Fed for continuing to raise rates, oblivious to the damage it was doing to the real economy. My people have been in this game for 25 years, and they are losing their jobs, and these firms are going to go out of business, and he's nuts. They're nuts. They know nothing.
Cramer.
I have not seen it like this since I went five bid for a half a million shares of Citigroup and I got hit in 1990. This is a different kind of market, and the Fed is asleep.
Okay, but here's the thing.
Bill Poole is a shame. He's shameful. They know nothing. They know nothing. They know nothing. They know nothing. Oh, excuse me. What did I mean by that? Well, shortly before I came out to the set that moment to be interviewed by my old friend Aaron Burnett, I had been talking to the heads of, of one Wall Street firm about problems in the mortgage market. Pretty much everyone who followed this market, which is incredibly important to the health of the economy, knew that there were a lot of unsound practices occurring. Still, it was jarring when I was told by this executive that he couldn't believe how many people were beginning to default on their mortgages. He talked about how many mortgages of the 2005 vintage. He used a term that I had really before then only associated with fine wine. Just weren't money good. Something that only had happened once in our country's history and was never supposed to happen again. The Great Depression. I was aghast. But you know what? I had a lot of friends and a lot of firms. So what I did, I started making a lot of calls. I wanted to see if this 2005 vintage thing was in trouble everywhere. I was ashen when I got off the phone as the problem seemed to be spreading like wildfire. I called mortgage bankers. I called guys who ran major Wall Street firms. Everybody said it. And that's why I went off so strongly on my rant. Oh, well, the Fed didn't listen, especially Bill Poole, who at the time was an important Fed official who was so sanguine about things that I had to single him out in the rant. Years later, I found out when the Fed's transcripts were released from that period that my rant was brought up. And the Fed had a hearty laugh about it. We then had a series of horrendous defaults of large banks and savings and loans, some of which were thought to be too big to fail and failed anyway, including the largest savings and loan and two of the largest and most fabled brokerage houses. I did my best to try to get people out, including going on the Today Show to urge people who needed money near term to take it out of the stock market, lest it be lost. Whatever money you may need for the next 5 years, please take it out of the stock market right now. Whew. I don't think many listened, and the market fell another 40% before it bottomed. If you had bought any time from when the stock market peaked at 14,000 until it was cut more than in half by March 9th of 2009, you did lose a fortune. So how do you know to avoid buying this kind of dip? Isn't that what we need to learn? How do you avoid this kind of dip versus buying that Black Monday opportunity of 87? The first thing you have to ask yourself is about the economy. Is business really getting crushed? Is employment so important when considering the direction of the stock market falling off and falling off hard? Is the Fed standing pat or even raising rates when there are signs of real cracks like major firms going under or big companies unable to pay bills? Are there actual runs on multiple financial institutions around the country, not just in one area? If the answer is yes, then you have a decline that could be deeply rooted and joined at the hip with the real economy. And that has what I mentioned is systemic risk, meaning that the entire country could collapse. That's how it was back then. And it is why I get so angry when I hear people say, this is going to be as bad or worse than 2007, 2009, when there's, of course, nothing like that occurring, because like I said, only twice in 80 years. You don't expect systemic risk to continue to happen. That's not the way it works in our country. Second, if you want to know if there's anything in place that can actually save the economy or actually turn it around, that's important too. Even if the government tried to intervene with a troubled asset program and the SEC tried to institute rules that forbade short selling, none of those things mattered. What brought the market out of its funk was a statement by Ben Bernanke, a forceful statement on 60 Minutes, no less, that he would no longer let any more banks go under in our country. Before that, we had watched as the Fed had pretty much indicated it was unable to stop anything dramatic from occurring. Bernanke was no longer worried about such niceties, and a bottom was put in. Were there ways to spot the bottom? I got a couple of signs that can help. One that I monitor closely is the Standard & Poor's Oscillator. That's a paid subscription product that I get, which is updated after the close of trading every day. It measures buying or selling pressure. When you get a minus 5, that indicates that there's most likely too much selling. When you get a minus 10, you got to do some buying. We were getting signals that were much worse than that near the bottom as a sign that it was time to buy. Another way to look at it, I like to say who's been pessimistic or concerned about stocks, but has been reluctant to say anything positive, who then changes his tune. The best example of that kind of switch came from the late, great Mark Haynes, who had this to say back then.
However, I'm going to step out on a limb here.
We've been waiting for this.
I think we're at a bottom. I really do.
Look at that. March 10 of 2009, the day after Bernanke was on 60 Minutes. And that's why we call it the Haynes bottom. It bottomed. It was that much of a contrarian call from someone who hadn't been willing to make one until that moment. Now, it certainly made a ton of sense to sell what I said to sell. But before you say it to yourself, what happens if no one warns you again the next time? Well, you know what? I've got some good news for you. It's a little sobering, but it's good. If you waited long enough, 6 years to be exact, you actually did get back to where you were before the bear market began. All right. Yeah, 6 years. But if you had sat tight, you eventually did get back to even. And since then, well, of course, you made a lot of money. Yes, it would have been better to take something off the table. But one of the reasons why I am always, always, always stressing that it might just pay to sit tight if you haven't sold is because even in the worst stock market and economic moment of our lifetime, you still did fine if you bought and held. So here's the bottom line. Beware of the Chicken Littles of the world. Be mindful that there are tons of people who cry wolf every time we're down for a couple of days. But then again, there has been one time where it paid to actually sell, when there was real systemic risk, remember that term, to the U.S. economy. Unless there is again, it's okay to do some selling, but otherwise, maybe just sit tight and wait for those signals to buy. Donna in Pennsylvania, Donna!
Hey, Jim. My husband watches you all the time and really trusts your opinion.
Oh, fabulous, fabulous.
I want to invest $5,000 for my grandson's first birthday. for him to use for college or a down payment on a house when he gets older. I know that it's a volatile market, and I want to invest long-term, but I want to be defensive against sell-off. So what's my best way to go?
All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to divide that $5,000 into $1,000 each time. You're going to put the $5,000 in, $1,000 at a time. Why don't you do this? Wait every other month, $1,000 say January, then $1,000 in March until it's all in. That way, if you do get a big sell-off in the interim, then put all of it in that's left at once. That's my rule, and it's worked for me literally since 1979. Let's go to Jacob in Florida. Jacob!
Hey, Mr. Kramer.
How are you,
sir? Thanks for taking my call. This is Jacob from Tallahassee, Florida.
Tallahassee! Let's go to Jim and Mills for some barbecue.
Yes, absolutely. My question for you, sir, is when there's a bear market, and I have a stock that's been performing well consistently in the past, what factors do you look at to decide whether to get out or if you should hold on to it for the long term?
Well, in the end, it's going to come down to if it's a bear market, we're going to look for companies with incredible balance sheets that we think have not borrowed too much money and therefore can ride it out. And then we'll ride it out right with them. Sellers, beware. Beware of the chicken littles. Unless there's systemic risk, be mindful when investors cry wolf. Much more Mad Money ahead, including interest rate intrigue. I'm explaining how to handle sell-offs in the wake of interest rate hikes. Then, think I've covered all the ways to sell off? Think again. My strategy session continues. And I'm taking all your tweets, so send your questions my way. And, of course, stick with Kramer. In tonight's special survival guide edition of Mad Money, we're discussing how to deal with brutal sell-offs. Specifically, how to defend against them, take advantage of them even. I've told you not to be glib about the systemic risk sell-offs that involve the potential collapse of the U.S. economy. But those are easy to spot because it will seem like the world's falling apart, like in 2008. You don't need me for that. But now I want to help you game out the other less dangerous kind of crash, the mechanical kind caused by a broken market in a healthy economy. The best way to deal with these sudden declines is to recognize that there's a bottoming process, one that you can spot. So what should you do? I like to look for what are called accidentally high yielders. I used to call them AHYs on the show. Those are stocks of companies that are doing fine and have good balance sheets, but their stocks have fallen so low that their dividends are starting to give you an outstanding return, not one that you could ever believe would be from such a high-quality company. How do you spot these? I like to look at the historic level of dividend yields you've gotten from certain stocks, as well as the rate the 10-year Treasury gives you. If a stock typically yields, say, 2% and suddenly is paid double that because of a market-wide decline, that means the stock went down, then you're probably looking at what we call an accidental high yield. As long as the stock's been going down for no particular reason. That's why I like to look at companies that aren't particularly sensitive to the economy. Second, if the yield level isn't constructive or giving you opportunities, I'd use a mechanical sell-off to pick some stocks that you like and begin to buy them using what's known as wide scales. That's what I recommended during the 2010 flash crash. Pick one of the best stocks out there, a premier stock, and buy some using limit orders only. Don't use market orders because you might end up getting terrible prices. Frankly, you should never use market orders, but it's especially stupid during a crash. I like this method because if the market does come right back, as it did in the two flash crashes, you've picked up some terrific merchandise at amazing prices. Then you can flip the stocks if you want to for big profits, or you can hold on to them. But take a look. I demonstrated how to do this in the flash crash of 2010. 49.25 bid for 50,000 Proctor if I were at my hedge fund. I mean, this is a good opportunity.
They were just taking that point. I mean, that's an incredible. I mean, that name.
When
nothing
I walked
has
out,
changed
it was
for Procter
61.
And Gamble
nothing.
In the past
well, see,
4 minutes.
When I walked out, it was a 61. I'm not that interested in it. It's at 47. Well, that's a different security entirely. So what you have to do, though, you have to use limit orders because Procter just jumped 7 points that I said I liked it at 49. So, I mean, you know, you got to be careful. That's the craziness I'm talking about. And a lot of people ended up doing that Procter trade. So I always feel good. Remember, the limit order advice still rings true. Now, we've covered how to recognize systemic risk and how to sidestep it, and we've talked about how to profit from mini crashes. How about the rest of the sell-offs we experience? The garden variety pullbacks, those are the most common types by far. What causes these declines? Well, there are a bunch of different varieties. First, you've got sell-offs caused by the Federal Reserve, probably the most important because they're top of mind. And that's the most frequent reason for stock dumping. There's a reason the business media is constantly talking about the Fed. When the economy is weakening, the Federal Reserve's job is to try to restore growth. As long as the Fed is cutting interest rates, almost every decline is a viable one, unless there's systemic risk, of course. It's just a fact of life. It's been like that since I got in the business. But when the economy is strengthening and perhaps even overheating, the Fed has a different mandate. In an expansion, its job is to temper growth in order to stop inflation. And look, the Fed is right to be worried. Inflation erodes the purchasing power of individuals and makes it so your dollars buy fewer and fewer goods, and your savings are less likely to cover your long-term needs. But we don't want the Fed to break the economy. And here I'm talking about the B-R-E-A-K kind, like it did when it raised rates 17 straight times in lockstep going into the Great Recession. Now, there are plenty of times when the Fed's tightening and the stock market wasn't crushed because the economy wasn't crushed. However, whenever the Fed tightens, some prognosticators will come out of the woodwork to tell you the market will crash or at least take a very big header. It's inevitable. So when you hear or read these comments, do not panic. Fed rate hikes don't necessarily lead to crashes. In fact, I've seen plenty that do next to nothing. But there are rational reasons why the stock market should and does go down when the Fed raises rates. First, stocks are only one of the assets available to individuals and institutions. There's gold, real estate, and of course, the bonds. I like gold as a safe haven, and I believe that every person should hold some gold, preferably bullion. But if not, then the GLD is a hedge against inflation. But otherwise, as we've seen, gold hasn't been able to protect you against much in the last two decades. Consider it a hedge against a catastrophe that hasn't yet occurred. Real estate, actual real estate can be a good hedge. But most people don't have the money to invest in the kinds of real estate that big institutions can buy. Now, we do have real estate investment trusts, but they're not reliable as a proxy for real estate. Finally, we have bonds as an investment alternative, and bonds are the source of the problem when the Fed raises rates. As the Fed tightens, bonds, particularly short-term pieces of paper, become more competitive with stocks. You'll notice that as the Fed jacks up rates, high-yielding dividend stocks are going to be among the worst performers. That's because their yields suddenly look a lot less attractive versus what you can get from bonds, and their stocks are inherently more risky than treasuries. So please be careful of these stocks as safe havens when the sell-off is caused by the Fed. They're very different from accidental high-yielders that can spring back when the Fed is tightening. The second reason why stocks can go down legitimately when the Fed raises rates, because the Fed isn't perfect. I keep talking about those 17 lockstep rate hikes. Well, because the Fed isn't perfect. The Fed kept tightening and tightening long after it should have stopped. They've raised rates when they should have stood pat because the economy was already slowing, or even cutting rates fast because of what was going on underneath. When that's the case, sell-offs can materialize going to the Fed meeting, and then the pain will continue after. You get that kind of pullback, and you need to be extra careful not to be aggressive buying any stocks, especially the defensive high-yielding bond market alternative stocks, because they're not going to work. Here's the bottom line. Garden variety pullbacks can be gamed as long as there's no systemic risk. But sell-offs in the wake of the Fed raising rates, those are trickier, although they can lead to decent opportunities, as long as you stay away from the high yielders that become less attractive when the Fed tightens and stick with the accidentally high yielders that might just give you that delicious bounce when the Fed is done tightening. Mad Money's back after the break. Tonight we're talking sell-offs, specifically during this block, what causes garden variety pullbacks. Many times the problem is indeed the Fed, as I mentioned before the break. But sometimes there are other issues that are really important. For starters, there's the issue of margin. As a former hedge fund guy, I'm well aware that there are many times when money managers borrow more money than they should. So when the stock market goes down, they don't have the capital to meet the margin clerk's demands. These kinds of margin-induced declines have happened repeatedly, including in the beginning of 2018, when funds that had borrowed money to bet against stock market volatility, the so-called VIX, got their heads handed to them. They were short the VIX, betting the market would remain calm, stupid people. And against them, they bought the S&P 500 using borrowed money. Again, real stupid. When the stock market fell, these managers were forced to sell their S&P 500 positions and unwind their trades. There were so many managers doing this at once that their selling ended up causing some severe market-wide losses. These margin-induced breakdowns often occur after several days where the market's down. That's why I'm often reluctant to tell you to be aggressive in the first few days of a big decline, because there are always going to be margin clerks against these managers who buy stocks with borrowed money. They're going to have to keep chopping. How do you spot these declines and when they're going to be over? You know what? I use the clock. Margin clerks don't want their firms to be on the hook for overstretched individuals or hedge funds. So margin clerks demand that collateral be put up, raise some cash, or they sell you out of your positions without your say-so. I always consider the margin clerk the butcher, and the butchering occurs between 1 and 2 o'clock. If the selling runs its course by 2:45 p.m., yes, I find it to be actually that specific, then I think you have a decent chance to start buying safety stocks, the kind of stocks that tend not to be, not to need the economy to be strong in advance, to advance, like, you know, like the healthcare stocks. You might also want to buy the stocks of the fastest growing companies with great secular themes that work in any environment. And I talk about them all the time. What else can create viable opportunities? Sell-offs from overseas. I cannot tell you how often I've heard commentators who scare the bejesus out of us because of imported worries from, say, Greece or Cyprus, Turkey, Venezuela, Mexico, countless other places. I always tell you to ask yourself, do any of these woes really impact the stocks of the American companies you've invested in and how much we should pay for them? Do you see any real impact? Do they really make you want to pay dramatically less for an individual stock? Usually the answer is no. Unfortunately, though, you can't just start buying hand over fist. You should always assume there are people who don't understand how unimportant these worries are in the vast scheme of things. And, of course, these people are going to sell, even panic sell, if you would have thought that they'd know better. That's why these international declines often last for 3 days. Again, the best way to figure out if they're done is to watch the clock, as the sellers usually need to be margined out against their will if there's going to be a bottom. Another kind of sell-off, the IPO-related decline. Remember, at the end of the day, stock markets are markets first and foremost, and markets are controlled by supply and demand. So if the bankers start rolling out lots of new IPOs and then those companies sell more shares via secondary offerings, you could end up in a situation where there's just much too much supply and not enough demand. My suggestion, avoid the blast zone, please, the area where most of the new IPOs are concentrated, and focus on the stocks that are down because of collateral damage. Sometimes we get declines triggered by multiple simultaneous earnings shortfalls. You need to be real nimble with these. If you want to buy stocks after an earnings-induced pullback, isolate the sectors where the shortfalls are occurring and avoid them. There's no reason to be a hero here, people. Instead, buy stocks that have been hit by much broader selling via the S&P 500 futures that have nothing to do with what went wrong. Then there's the trickiest kind of risk, one that's really truly Tolstoy-esque, political risk. I often find this risk tremendously overblown, whether it's because of strife between parties or trade policies or even all-out war, with the exception, of course, of nuclear war, where money should be the last thing you're worried about. I'm not a political guy, and I hate talking about this stuff. But with every stock you own, you need to ask yourself, does this company have direct earnings risk when it comes to Washington? If not, then you've got nothing to worry about. However, if you own something that's directly impacted by, say, a trade dispute with China, government shutdown, that could turn into a house of pain. I know political risk is enticingly negative and fearful because there are so many pundits everywhere wading in and giving you their 2 cents. These guys want to scare you. My suggestion? Tune it out, please. Instead, look for companies that have nothing to do with the political fray, even as their stocks have been brought down by it. I can't tell you how many times since 1979 I've seen politics used as a reason to sell stocks. They may be a reason to sell some stocks, but rarely has anything in Washington been enough to sell everything. Here's the bottom line. There are all sorts of sell-offs, but unless they involve systemic risk, they're going to prove to be buying opportunities. You just need to recognize why the sell-off is occurring. Note the signs that it might be subsiding, and then take action to buy, not sell, and never to panic. Stick with Cramer. You know me, I always say I have the smartest audience in television. I'd love to hear from you, so let's get to some of your tweets. First up, at CIA 1857 tweets, "Hi, Jim. I am in a little bit of a dilemma. My Mad Money is 95% allocated, but I know I should have more cash. At the same time, I don't want to sell at the bottom. What should I do? Thank you very much in advance." Okay, this is really important. You got to listen to me. Do not sell until we get some lift. I know that a lot of people feel, well, there will never be lift. There always is. And then after the second day, after a lift, the second day, you sell at the opening. Okay. Next up, a tweet from Todd Pally. "Hey, it's Jim Cramer. This kid could be mini you. Hashtag Cramerica, hashtag mad money."
"Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. So if you're trying to make some friends, I'm trying to make some money."
Kid's got horse sounds. Next up, from Fat Dave Hayseed, 1975. Chuck him with the Jim Cramer, an audiobook that's gotten lots of use. I get something more out of hashtag Get Rich Carefully every time. Thank you so much. I cannot believe how hard those audiobooks are to read. That took me about four straight weekends and a lot of nights. I'm glad you're getting something out of it. Next up, a tweet from at Mike House 516 at Jim Cramer, Mad Money on CNBC. Can you talk a little about how rule number one, bulls make money, bears make money, pigs get slaughtered, applies to my S&P 500 index fund? It's been a long run. If this is bedrock money for retirement, you do not touch it. If it's money to put away for kids, you do not touch it. For school, do not touch it. I am talking about mad money that should be traded and taken some off the table. Not that basic index fund. That's to be run for as long as you can stand it. Stick with Kramer. I like to say there's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to try to find it just for you right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer. See you next time.